Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. I'm John Diaz, editorial page editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for today. You can find Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Chris Hayes, editor-at-large of The Nation, host of MSNBC's Up with Chris Hayes, and author of the new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Chris Hayes is a veteran observer of American society and politics whose writings have appeared in many distinguished publications, including, of course, The Nation, where he's editor at large. His academic credentials include a BA in philosophy from Brown University and a stint as a fellow at Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Foundation Center for Ethics. His big break in broadcasting came as a guest host for Rachel Maddow when she was traveling in Afghanistan, and it took off from there. It did not take very long for MSNBC to realize that Chris merited his own show, and sure enough, in 2011, he became host of Up with Chris Hayes, a refreshingly in-depth look at issues of our times. Please join me in giving a welcome to Chris Hayes.
Thank you. Wielding the gavel makes me feel drunk with power. It's a very dangerous implement to have up here while I'm speaking. Let me time this. I'm not checking my email. I'm just putting a timer on so I know exactly
also
how long.
Also a clock up there, Chris, if that makes it easier for you.
All right, we'll do that the old-fashioned way. Clocks, right. What are those? Well, thank you all. It's really wonderful you're all here tonight. I'm deeply, deeply appreciative that you would come out on a weeknight and take time to come hear me talk. I'll start out maybe talking a little bit about why I wrote the book or how I started to think about wanting to write the book. I graduated from college in 2001, and the first decade of the 21st century was the first decade I found myself navigating the adult world as a citizen and covering public life as a journalist. And after that decade, what I call in the book the fail decade, which I'll get into in a second, my overriding sensation in attempting to think about public life and attempting to responsibly report on what was going on in the nation was one of profound frustration and disorientation. I felt deeply and viscerally that I didn't quite know who I could trust, what I could trust, what sources of authority had managed to survive intact the wreckage of the last decade. And this manifests itself in all kinds of ways. I mean, even now, I sit there and have a TV show, and we are going to talk about Iran's nuclear program. I just have no idea. I mean, I read all the reporting, and there's blind sources from Shin Bet who say this about the Iranian nuclear program, and there's sources who say this about the Iranian nuclear program. And all of the different habits of mind that I might have relied on before the WMD disaster in Iraq seem deeply, deeply, profoundly discredited. And that, to me, is one of the foundational overriding experiences of life in America at the end of the failed decade. And that general visceral sense of disquiet, unease, and disorientation, I was looking through the internet. I came up on the blog of the great Nate Silver, who's at the New York Times now, 538. And he had just had this little post, and it was a little bit of data from the General Social Survey, which is one of the most in-depth and reliable studies of American public opinion over time that we have. And it was polling on people's trust in their pillar institutions. How much do you trust the news media or newspapers, medicine, science, religion, Congress? And he just had been looking through this data, and it caught his eye, and he said, you know, all of these have come down quite a bit in this decade. And somehow that seemed to grab some part of me. It made me feel that my own feeling of unease was matched by something actually reflected in public opinion. So you start to look at this data, and there's the General Social Survey, there's Pew, there's Gallup, and what you see is America is in the midst of a wrenching and profound crisis of authority. It is reflected in polling that shows across all different kinds of polls historically low levels of public trust in our pillar institutions. And this polling, ironically enough, it starts in the 1970s. And the reason it starts in the 1970s, most of it starts in 1972, 73, which is the aftermath of course, the grisly end of Vietnam and Watergate. And that was the last period in time when America was having a discussion about a crisis of authority. In fact, it was one of the dominant discussions happening. This is James Reston writing, famous New York Times Washington Bureau chief, writing in 1970 before Watergate, who says, behind all the questions of politics, ideologies, and personalities lies the larger issue of public confidence and trust in the institutions of the nation. That trust does not exist now. The authority of the government, of the church, of the university, and even of the family is under challenge all over the republic, and men of all ages, 1970s, so. Men of all ages, stations, and persuasions agree that this crisis of confidence is one of the most important and dangerous problems of the age. The irony is that that polling that was conducted in the wake of Vietnam and Watergate, in the midst of what Reston and others noticed was a crisis of authority, shows that what they thought was a nadir of public trust in the institutions was actually the high watermark. That period that Reston is describing, the period immediately in the aftermath of Watergate, which had to be one of the most wrenching betrayals in the history of the republic, certainly the most wrenching betrayal under the lights of modern media, public trust in our institutions was higher than it is now. So then you think to yourself, okay, well, why is public trust in our pillar institutions so low? And I think there's more or less two theories. And there's one theory that says the problem isn't institutional performance. The problem isn't failure. The problem is the distrust itself, which is caused by a toxic media environment. We've created this 24-hour news cycle. It's driven by and fueled by negativity and cynicism. And that severs the bonds of trust between people and their institutions. And in fact, Robert Bennett, senator from Utah, Republican senator from Utah, who was unceremoniously shown the door by the Republicans of the state of Utah in that state's GOP convention because he was insufficiently conservative in their eyes. You know, he said this to me as I was interviewing him. He said, you know, if people read responsible publications, if they just read the Washington Post editorial page, then we can get somewhere. But, you know, people reading the blogs, and they're ticked off at us because everything we say is a lie, and they have no respect for the institutions and those of us who labor institutions. And that's the problem. And David Brooks sometimes makes this argument in the pages of the New York Times op-ed page that the problem is the distrust. And I don't think this is a ridiculous argument or one that should be dismissed out of hand. I mean, in another media environment, right, we would not all have seen Anthony Weiner's crotch, right? And it's hard to make the case the Republic is any better off for having had the privilege. So there's something to this, right? I mean, we are exposed more... exposed to the foibles of people in power more reliably. But I don't think that that's a very sufficient or satisfying explanation. I think actually if you take a step back and you look at the institutional performance we've had over the last decade, it's quite poor. And I think Occam's razor would suggest that the simplest explanation here is that people do not trust our pillar institutions because our pillar institutions have shown themselves to be untrustworthy. If you're writing a work of social criticism or talking about, you know, how we're living now, I think there's an understandable impulse to say, well, why is it really any worse now? We've had problems in the past. We'll have problems in the future. What's so bad about now? And I think if you take a step back and you think about this decade, the decade that began with Bush v. Gore, and then 19 men with box cutters overcoming the most expensive security apparatus in the history of human civilization to commit the worst mass murder in the country's history, followed by the largest corporate bankruptcy of all time, Enron at the time, which now, of course, appears quaint in wake of what would happen afterwards, and then the largest foreign policy, moral, and strategic blunder in at least a generation since Vietnam, 4,500 American dead, thousands more wounded, 100,000 Iraqis dead, 100,000 Iraqis dead at the low ends of the estimates, $850 billion burned like oil fires in the desert. And after that, the spectacle of a major American city drowning live on national television while we all watched helpless, 1,000 people dead there. And from there, a very short, quick step to an $8 trillion housing bubble and a financial crisis that's the worst in 70 years, and a recession and labor market that are still attempting to pull themselves out from the wreckage. So I don't think it's ridiculous to say it has been a particularly crappy decade. And so the question then becomes, why have we had this cascade of institutional failure? Why have we had this seemingly unending march of disaster, crisis, catastrophe, incompetence, corruption? Part of it, I think, is chance and confluence. There are contingent attributes to different parts of these failures. But I think at the core of a lot of it is what I would say is elite failure. People who are, quote, in charge, not doing a very good job of being in charge. So then the question becomes, well, why is that the case? What is it about the ways in which we select or form elites that or the institutions in which they're embedded and running that we produce seemingly this tendency towards elite failure? And I started working on that problem, and I found myself back at my high school. I went to a really amazing and special place for high school. I was a kid from the Bronx, working class kid. My dad was a community organizer. My mom was an educator. And in sixth grade, I stood online outside a very intimidating huge armory on the Upper East Side of Manhattan to take a test to get me into a public magnet school called Hunter College High School. Awesome. Fell out alone. Groovy. There's a certain smug solidarity that graduates share. I copped to that myself, by the way. I have none of that. The school's a really remarkable place. It is a public magnet school. It is free. It's open to kids from all five boroughs. And it has one entrance criteria, which is this one test that kids take when they're 11. You get in. There's some kids who get in elementary school, and then they track through. They also have testing in elementary school. But the vast majority of the kids that get in happen through this one test when they're 11. And what's amazing about the place is that it embodies the meritocratic ideal in many ways, right? Everyone takes the same test, and it's one metric you're judged on. And what that means is, even if you're having a bad day, or obviously kids are coming from very different educational backgrounds, but the positive thing about such an austere entrance vision is that it's much harder to game. You can't donate a science wing to the library and get your kid in, or if Mayor Bloomberg's daughter tests and doesn't get a sufficiently high score, she's not going to get in. And there's precious few institutions in American life about which that could credibly be said. I talked to the president of Hunter College that runs Hunter High School, and she said, you wouldn't believe the phone calls I get. I was like, I could believe the phone calls you get. It's New York City, and good education is a valuable and scarce commodity, and people are willing to pay for it. But the school does hew to this very intense, austere meritocratic vision. The level playing field, people competing from all walks of life, children of Pakistani immigrants and Latino kids from the Bronx and Korean kids from Flushing, and Russian immigrants from Coney Island. And what has happened is that over time, the school has grown, the admissions of black and Latino students to the school has declined considerably. Now, black and Latino students have always been underrepresented in the school because of the intensely unequal distribution of educational quality in the city and the coincidence between race and poverty in New York City, broadly in the country at large, but particularly in the city. And so kids are coming from very different places with very different skill sets from their primary school education. In fact, one interesting side note is that the entrance in for the four-year-olds, right, for the elementary school is much more diverse because those life trajectories haven't had as much time to work their unequal dark magic. But what has happened over time is that even Black and Latino students that were underrepresented to begin with have declined quite alarmingly to the point where there is now, I think fair to say, a sense of panic inside the school about what it would look like to admit a class with not a single Black or Latino student. Recently, the most recent records we have were the admitted class is 3% African American and 1% Latino in a city that is majority Black and Latino. So what explains this? Well, there's a lot of things that explain this, partly the inequities that I talked about before in terms of the way that educational resources and social capital are distributed in the city. But there's also the growth of a test prep industry that's happened in the last 15 years around the Hunter entrance exam. It didn't exist when I took the test, but it exists now, and it exists, I guess, somewhat inevitably. Like I said, it's a scarce resource. It's a valuable resource. And if you have the means to pay for it, it's a no-brainer. I mean, this is 6 years. It goes from 7th to 12th grade, right? 6 years of good private education in the city is upwards of $200,000. And the education in Hunter is remarkably good. So this test prep industry has grown up, in which you can pay several thousand dollars for a cram school during winter break, in which your child spends hours and hours every day during winter vacation prepping for the test. And there are several of these. You can hire a tutor for $90 or $100 an hour in the wealthier precincts of Manhattan. And people I've talked to around the school, and I did some reporting for the book, more or less conclude that at this point the majority, perhaps the vast majority of students who get in are the products of some test prep regime. Now, the causation on this stuff gets hard to delineate, right? There's a certain amount of self-selection here. Who are the kinds of kids that are getting this test prep anyway? Maybe they would test above. But to me, this story of Hunter, this place that I love very dearly, is a perfect parable for the ways in which meritocracies break down. The fundamental division at the heart of this meritocratic vision, and it's the vision that we have largely adopted as our social model in the wake of the social upheavals of the 1960s, is this division between equal opportunity and equal outcomes. We've decided that we are not going to have an elite that is closed off to people because of race or creed or national origin or gender or sexual orientation or geography. We're not going to have a northern white WASP establishment and an old boys club. People from all walks of life and all different backgrounds will compete on the level playing field, which is the metaphor we always invoke, which, funnily enough, was invented by a bank lobbyist in the 1970s to fight against bank regulation. Fun fact, level playing field. That we're going to compete on this level playing field, and this process of competition is going to produce this set of people that get winnowed down in a kind of tournament-like fashion, to the group of people that will be elites, that will have high levels of professional success, remuneration, political power, influence, etc. And Barack Obama is the crowning achievement of that system. And it is a great testament to that social model that he is, in fact, president of the United States, because it is only under that social model that in the history of the Republic that a man with that name and skin color coming from where he came from could be president of the United States. And it's a credit to meritocracy that's the case. And yet at the same time we have adopted this model, we have seen massively increasing inequality, and more importantly, but I think less covered, declining social mobility. The odds of beginning in the bottom of the income distribution and getting to the top over the course of a lifetime or across generations, the odds of that are growing longer. We're seeing less social mobility, which is in fact the foundational promise of the meritocracy. The idea of rising from any station to as far as your talents and drive will get you. That is an old, old, old American dream. De Tocqueville writes about it. And yet, the meritocracy is not delivering on this foundational promise, or increasingly failing to. And to me, the story of Hunter is a kind of perfect parable about how this happens. Because Hunter can narrowly hew to its austere vision of equality of opportunity, of this single test that everybody waits online and goes through the door through, and everyone takes the same test. But clinging to that vision of equality of opportunity proves to be a very flimsy barrier indeed against the incursions of absolute actual inequality of outcomes that persist in the city at large. The test prep industry being just one emanation, one particularly acute emanation of that. I think that we have a society, a social model, that is breaking down before our eyes. A method of elite selection that is growing increasingly sclerotic and rigged and corrupt. And I think that this model of meritocracy, which essentially is a social consensus, it's not something that you ever really hear argued about or questioned. It's more or less what Democrats and Republicans talk about, is sowing the seeds of its own destruction and producing a set of elites who cannot but help fail. There's something about the culture of this process, and I should take a moment here to say that the obvious, which is that I'm pretty implicated in this. I mean, I'm a product of these institutions. I have a television show now. So, you know, I'm part of the elite that's failing. It's a dispatch from my people, I guess. One of the effects of this model of meritocracy, talk sort of psychological effects in this mechanism of elite formation, one of the effects is that it requires of everyone that ascends through it to create for themselves a story of overcoming. Because the vision of success is one of overcoming, from coming from the outside to the inside through hard work, through talent, through ability. Right? So I'm tempted to do this myself, right? I mean, the story that I want to tell about myself is this scrappy kid from the outer boroughs in the Bronx, and I tested well, and I worked hard in school, and I got into an Ivy League school, and now I have a TV show. It's the American dream, right? But of course, you know, that erases a tremendous amount of privilege. It erases the fact that I'm a white straight man in a society that gives a lot of benefits to white straight men. It erases the fact that I was just, through sheer luck and lottery, born into a family of two tremendously remarkable and admirable people who were unfailingly compassionate and nurturing and valued education and set us, me and my brother, on a pretty remarkable path. I had nothing to do with that. And all of those endowments and all that privilege is erased from the story, but the story I want to tell and the story that gets stoked by the system we have is that story of the overcoming. And this is true even in cases in which it's manifestly ridiculous. Mitt Romney got up at the Republican presidential primary debate, and he said, "I could have inherited the car company, but I walked away." "Struck out on my own to Harvard Law and Harvard Business School." "I found a bank capital. I've earned every dollar that I made." And his wife, Ann Romney, gave an interview to a reporter talking about their years living in dingy student housing at BYU, in which she had to staple carpet samples together to cover the floor, and that when times got really rough, she told the reporter, they would have to sell some of the stock that Mitt had inherited. So we're all laughing because that's an obviously ridiculous story, but I guarantee you that is genuinely felt. That is not put on. People feel that they have overcome. That is part of what the system produces. The other thing it produces is this kind of ceaseless competition. The distribution of income at the top just keeps rising further and further up you go. Sometimes people don't grasp it. We have this rough 1%, 99% framework that is the result of Occupy. But, you know, the remarkable thing about the income distribution over the last 20 or 30 years is that if you zoom into the 1%, the top tenth of top 1% is doing way, way better than everyone else in the 1%. And if you zoom in on the top tenth of 1%, the top hundredth of 1% is doing way, 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 way better than the rest of the top tenth of 1%. And in the book, I call this fractal inequality. It's sort of this self-similarity at every level of analysis. And what this looks like in person, I went to cover Davos for the book. And, you know, you go to Davos and you're on the plane to Davos. You're thinking like, yeah, Davos. I'm inside. And, you know, you get off the plane and it's a very beautiful, of course, impeccable airport. The Swiss are very neat and clean, nicely designed. And you start to walk up to this stand where you get a ticket, free ticket, to take a shuttle bus the 2 hours into the ski town. And when you're doing that, you're noticing that there are these folks who are on first class, and they're getting shuttled out by this sort of cohort of red-jacketed, extremely attractive young Swiss people who are then shuttling them into black Mercedes S-classes to be chauffeured there. And suddenly your perspective changes. You thought that you were on the inside. You thought that you were one of the elect, but now you realize you're just so much coach chattel that actually the real insiders are the folks who are in those Mercedes. And then, of course, let me see if I can find this little bit of the book. You can't do this on television, Bill. Give me a second here. And then, of course, you find out later, and those people who had been whisked into the Mercedes will find out later, that, in fact, the real ballers don't mess around with cars. They take a helicopter over the Alps. That is really the way to go. And this just keeps unfolding. And Anya Shiffrin is a great writer and editor and also happens to be married to Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize winner and regular Davos attendee. She wrote this. She said, "The point about Davos is that it makes everyone feel wildly insecure. Billionaires and heads of state alike are all convinced that they have been given the worst hotel rooms, put on the least interesting panels, excluded from the most important events, most interesting private dinners. The genius of world economic founder Klaus Schwab is that he has been able to persuade hundreds of accomplished businessmen to pay thousands of dollars to attend an event that is largely based on mass humiliation and paranoia." And this relates to something, and I'll conclude here, and then we'll do some questions. This relates to an amazing speech that C.S. Lewis gave in 1945 at King's College. And he was addressing graduates. And he said to him, "Have you ever had the experience of walking into a room and two people are speaking? And as soon as you walk in the room, they hush." He said, "If you've had that experience, and I'm quite sure you have, you have experienced the allure of the inner ring, the desire to be on the inside." He said, "I assure you over the course of your lives that that allure of the inner ring will produce the acts of which you are most ashamed. That the desire to be on the inside of the inner ring is the seedbed into which the seeds of corruption will fall." And as I look out at the model of American society, it seems to me that we have managed to construct a system that is nothing if not a concentric circle of inner rings. And I think that's producing a lot of the crisis. Let's do some questions.
Great. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
Our thanks to Thank you, Chris Hayes, editor-at-large at The Nation, host of MSNBC's Up with Chris Hayes, and author of the new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. Well, you've inspired quite a few questions, Chris, so let's get right to them. We had a number of questions along these lines that I would say, in essence, is what can I do? And this one would be typical. What type of political steps should be taken by citizens to limit the social inequality that you talk about?
So I'm an old-fashioned liberal on this. I mean, you know, there's a lot to be said for redistribution. Our system is not particularly redistributive. It's much less redistributive than it has been in the past. And when faced with a lot of inequality, the most clear-cut policy to deal with that inequality is to reduce it. You can reduce it through tax and transfer. You could reduce it through increasing provision of public goods, secondary education at the state level, which is being gutted through budget cuts right now, and fees and tuition are going up. public goods like the provisioning of health care, increasing the minimum wage. There's a whole list of things that you can do that will reduce inequality. Higher marginal tax rates. You know, the problem, of course, is the political problem of getting that done. Both political opposition that's grounded in people's firmly held and genuine beliefs that those are bad for the economy as a whole or unjust, and then also just the entrenched interests of people that, for instance, pay 15% rate on carried interest and don't want to part with that, thank you very much. I mean, I don't blame them, but they should part with it. So there are things you can do politically to reduce inequality. I don't think the policies are necessarily rocket science. I think the problem is mounting the political will and creating a political constituency that is in favor of it.
Here's a question. We are in San Francisco, but we actually may have a conservative in the audience.
I'm glad.
It says, what incentive do your proposals give the elites to continue to accumulate capital, human or otherwise, and to strive to be elite when the marginal benefit of investment under your scheme is essentially zero? Who do you suggest should administer the factors of production, the government, for example?
So no to the last question. I'm also not proposing a 100% confiscatory top marginal tax rate. Roosevelt proposed this, actually. Over $350,000 in income, he proposed a maximum income, which it didn't go anywhere. So the standard argument that the questioner is channeling is an argument for why inequality is good. And the argument is that inequality produces incentives for risk-taking, investment, hard work, productivity. And those are not ridiculous arguments. They hold at certain levels. I mean, if we did have a system in which... I'm a believer in incentives. If we had a system in which every marginal dollar was taxed such that everyone made the exact same amount of money, yes, you would see behavior alter radically. But there's a huge amount of space between that and what we have now. And I'm just totally unconvinced by this investment story or this behavioral story. I mean, it's not like we've had a huge boom of investment under years of historically low top marginal rates. It's also not the case that I don't think the actual behavioral incentives are as linked to top marginal rates as the people who are advocating that story say they are. It's very hard for me to think that Mark Zuckerberg doesn't keep creating stuff if he's paying, 10% more on his top marginal rate. That's an unconvincing story to me. So yeah, a certain amount of inequality is obviously necessary. I think to me it is obvious that it's necessary to incentivize all sorts of different things. But, you know, the flip side of this is that it actually produces cost. We should be very clear here. Like, you know, the argument of the book about inequality isn't an argument from justice. It's not that it's bad for people at the bottom of the social pyramid or it alienates them or it makes for stagnating wages. It's that it actually produces a worse caliber of elite. It produces worse elite decision making. And the other thing that's really, really important to think about in terms of these top marginal rates and in terms of what the incentives are in the top is that one of the lessons from Enron, one of the lessons from Major League Baseball, and one of the lessons from Wall Street during the housing bubble is this. It is trickier than it looks to produce a system with huge rewards for performance that is not also a system with huge rewards for cheating. Those two things can look very, very similar. It could be tough to tease them out. So the behavior you're incentivizing, and this is not necessarily, my own insight. This is something that has been written about in the economic literature. There was an amazing poll out today of folks on Wall Street about how much they felt that bonuses incentivized unethical behavior or corner cutting. And the problem, of course, in these settings, and this happened in Major League Baseball, is that if you introduce cheating into a highly competitive system with harsh rewards for punishment and high rewards for performance, it will catch on very quickly. Because if you don't participate in it, you're a sucker, and you're going to be out on your back. So there are costs, I think, real genuine costs, to that, to the way that we have the incentive structure ordered right now.
And certainly we see it in CEO pay, for instance.
And CEO pay is, CEO pay, it doesn't even hew to the meritocratic lines of Major League Baseball, where at least they're punishment for failure. I mean, CEO pay is remarkably rigged in all sorts of ways. I mean, first of all, it's tied to stock options in a way that means that if the market goes up in general, right, there's no way that most CEO compensation packages don't distinguish between market performance and the firm's performance over and above what the market is doing more broadly. And second of all, as we've seen time and time again, the cost of being fired or, the golden parachutes mean that you're pretty well compensated, even for failure.
Another audience question. Has anyone ever thought that the job creators should get their tax cuts only after they create jobs?
We've actually tried that in the tax code. I mean, that's been a proposal, like a hiring tax credit, to actually say you're going to give a tax credit for hiring. I think the job creators language is, problematic for a million different reasons. One of the things, there's a great essay that was in Reason magazine that I really liked. It's called, and from a very libertarian, pro-market perspective, and it was called The Myth of Market Meritocracy. And the idea was that, look, even under conventional libertarian, classical liberal vision of how a free market economy works, it's just not the case that it's like the best or most enlightened people who get the richest. It's the ideas that happen to work, right? And those ideas happen to work for a million different reasons: contingency, luck, being in the right place at the right time, or some kind of someone taking a flyer on something that in another context might have been crazy if he'd waited 2 years or been 2 years ahead of time, but actually works. And that produces actual productivity and gains and things that everyone can use. But it doesn't mean that there's some inherent elevated status. And the whole language about job creator strikes me as this strange, implicit idea that folks who are running firms, some of whom are incredibly brilliant and some of whom are not incredibly brilliant, like there are incredibly brilliant janitors and not incredibly brilliant janitors, that somehow there's something existentially and fundamentally different about job creators as a class of people. And I just don't think there's any evidence for that.
Reminder to our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our guest is Chris Hayes, MSNBC host and editor-at-large of The Nation. Tonight he is discussing America's lack of trust in both government and private sector leaders and what this holds for the future. Chris, a little prognostication. Audience member wants to know, what is your best guess of how the elite practice of pulling up the ladder from behind them is going to change for the better? Are you an optimist?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always an optimist. When you think about the systems of hierarchy the U.S. has had that have looked insurmountable and been upended, it's remarkable. I mean, the trust system, the fact that they were able to get an income tax put in the United States Constitution still boggles my mind. I mean, the temperance movement. Think about the temperance movement. I'm obsessed with the temperance movement because it's such a terrible idea. But they started organizing 50 years. Women's Christian Temperance Union is founded 50 years before the amendment is passed prohibiting alcohol. And they just kept at it and kept at it. Even a really terrible idea made it into the United States Constitution, which makes me oddly hopeful, right? That with enough grit, determination, and organization, good ideas can also prevail as well. And look, I mean, the society has had much worse, seemingly insurmountable, and morally bankrupt systems of hierarchy than the one we have now. I think the one we have now is destructive in a lot of ways. I think the financial crisis is an example of that. It's had much worse ones than we have now, and they've been toppled, or they've been ameliorated, or pushed in a better direction. And it seems to me quite defeatist to think that we don't have the wherewithal now.
You mentioned earlier the cuts in education funding at all levels, K-12, higher education. Question from an audience member. Do you believe that the continued defunding of public education in the United States is a deliberate attempt to dumb down the constituency and control the electorate?
No, I don't. I think that state legislatures are so ad hoc in the way that they conduct themselves and the way that budgets get put together that it's an easy place to make cuts in a lot of ways. There's a lot of antipathy towards teacher unions by Republicans, and so cutting teacher job salaries scores a kind of political benefit as well. There's antipathy towards, a lot of times, the institution of state universities by conservatives sometimes. But mostly, you know, states have to balance their budgets. And they're in dire straits because we're in the worst recession we've been in a very long time. And tax revenue is very low when joblessness is high and GDP growth is anemic. And they have to balance their budgets. And someone's ox is going to get gored. And it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be the ox of, you know, say, the people with the most amount of political power.
Whether it's deliberate or not, it does seem to be having that effect, though, doesn't it, in terms of putting the electorate in a case we see the young people have much less understanding of how the system works. We have a less educated electorate, fewer engaged electorate. So whether it was deliberate or not, it does have that effect, does it not?
I'm not sure if that's what's responsible. I mean, I think that it is remarkable the degree that we don't have. We no longer look at the educational system as an engine of citizenship as much as an engine of commerce. I mean, we view it entirely as a thing that prepares workers to enter the market, which is a huge part of its function. I mean, to have productive workers, we need people that have skills, and those skills are imparted in school. But part of the role, historically, of public education and its mission is also producing citizens. And those two roles sit side by side, sometimes uneasily. But you'd be hard-pressed to hear that the role of forming citizens mentioned by anyone when they talk about education now, or educational reform, or what we can do to create higher-achieving schools and higher-testing students. It's all about things that are equipment to be productive workers. And citizenship is important and something that needs to be cultivated.
Here's one of my favorite questions. You note in your book that to be called brilliant is the highest compliment that one can receive in this meritocracy. This audience member knows that 4/5 of your cover reviews refer to your book and you as brilliant. So the question is, do you have any advice to those of us, especially in law school, who do not receive this compliment often enough? Brilliant question.
Brilliant question, exactly. Well, law school is probably the place where this is the worst. Lawyers and law school, in my opinion, have this real... I talk about in the book the cult of smartness. The cult of smartness, and again, I'm implicated in this, right? Like, I like when people call me brilliant or smart or things like that. The cult of smartness is this idea that smartness is the signature virtue and the most important by far, as opposed to being one of many virtues along with, say, wisdom, compassion, prudence, empathy, judgment. And the other belief of the cult of smartness, which is really pernicious, is the idea that it's rankable and ordinal, like height. You know, like Michael Jordan is shorter than Yao Ming, but he's taller than Danny DeVito, and so-and-so is smarter than so-and-so, but not as smart as so-and-so, and that law school is all about that in a really, I think, kind of pernicious way. I think the reality of, I think smartness gets very reduced in our culture. I think there's lots of ways that people are smart, and I also think that, like, over some certain threshold, it's just all a wash. Like, people just have different interests, they have different levels of curiosity, they have different expertise, they look at things in different ways. And just the fine-grained distinctions that are made along this axis of smartness strike me as, like, really dumb, actually, as a way of thinking about human achievement and human potential.
You mentioned before we came out that your wife is an attorney.
She is, yes.
You're smart to bring that up here and not at home. question about your...
A brilliant attorney, I would add.
Speaking of maybe not so brilliant, what led you on this path to journalism from studying philosophy?
I studied philosophy as an undergrad and then flirted with the idea of going to grad school, but ultimately concluded that it seemed too remote. I have too much intellectual ADD to think of working on the same problem for 7 or 8 years. I think I would have been miserable. I'd make a terrible grad student. Started to think about journalism towards the end of my time in college as if you could make a living being professionally curious, that would be pretty sweet. If you can learn for your job, that would be awesome. And tried to kind of set about making that happen.
Makes sense. What kind of personal stories of the effects of meritocracy did you encounter while you were writing the book? Some particular stories that moved you?
I think it was interesting to talk about. There's two stories. One, I talked to a baseball player who was kind of occupied the hidden middle class of the major leagues. Like, when you think about major league baseball players, you think about very wealthy people and very esteemed and famous people. But, you know, the majority of, if you take the set of professional baseball players in America, which includes single A and double A and triple A, it looks a lot more like the 99% and the 1%, right? I mean, there's Alex Rodriguez and there's, you know, Manny Ramirez, etc., but there's just thousands of players in all levels who are really not making very much money, are playing on 30 or 60-day contracts. And this guy, Kelly Wunsch, he told me about the constant fear of getting sent down to the minors as a relatively successful but by no means superstar relief pitcher, setup man. And just kind of going through the details of that in this granular fashion, like, oh, God, it's May and my kid has another 6 weeks of school in this school. And if I get down to the majors, do I move the family? It's, you know, the AAA team is 1,000 miles away. Do I come back? Do I not see her? Once you get in the majors, you've been there for years, I just bought a condo. And so that he was talking about this in the context when we were talking about steroids, just about the way that stalking fear of losing performance, of being sent down, created this anxiety that made it very fertile ground for people to start looking for ways to get an advantage.
What kind of reception are you getting from the political elites to your book and some of the ideas that you're proposing? Are there political elites who are receptive to your ideas, and what are their characteristics?
I would like to say that I've gotten a lot of reaction from the elites, but I don't think they're reading the book. I mean, that's my... Or if they are, they have very little say about it. I'm not quite sure how much it's penetrated the consciousness, the book and the arguments of the book of say, Washington. My sense is that it hasn't. And, you know, there's a lot of books that come out. I think that inequality is increasingly penetrated the consciousness of Washington. And that's due to a confluence of factors in terms of political agitation around the issue and just the facts of the matter. The idea that the meritocracy is not working or bankrupt or corrupt or failing, I think is completely outside of the terms of the debate in Washington. I mean, I would like it to be part of it, but I would be lying if I said that.
Okay. You mentioned the influence, the negative influence of cable news on the American public
discourse. Did I say that? I don't know if I said that.
Well, the question is, do you feel that MSNBC is as responsible or holds some responsibility as well as Fox? The camera's rolling.
So, let me say this. I think that comparisons between the two networks are pretty wrong-headed because I think we do very different things. And that's self-justifying, so everyone can take that with a grain of salt, which I'm sure you are. But, you know, Fox is, you know, I talk about the difference of the two networks. I mean, Fox is run by a man whose entire life has been a political activist in conservative circles. Roger Ailes is a Nixon advisor, advisor to presidents, Republican conservative activist, believes in what he believes in, I think, completely honesty, and sees himself as having a mission and has a network that is part of that mission. And that is in turn owned by a man, Rupert Murdoch, who also has a set of politics that are very clear. He's not shy about the media enterprises that he owns, hew to that line, the Wall Street Journal editorial page, the British papers he owns, Fox News. They're engaged fundamentally in a political project. I can tell you that Comcast has no political project. And if they do, it is not the political project that I have on their network. And that my boss, Phil Griffin, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for and has been remarkably supportive in giving us a tremendous degree of latitude and unfettered editorial discretion, is someone who, whatever his personal politics are, comes out of the world of TV. He worked at the Today Show. He's been at MSNBC. He is a TV guy, and he wants to produce good TV that gets an audience, gets good ratings, sells advertising, and people like that television. He just is not running a political shop there. It's just when you see these memos that would go out from the head of Fox News to the different networks about this is how we're going to talk about the tax cuts or this is the proper phrase to use, I can tell you that just does not exist at my network. That said, are we in cable news writ large, as in whole, to blame for some of it? Yes. No question. Do we do sloppy things? Do we take cheap shots? Yes, we take cheap shots. Do we engage in trivialia in the news cycle? Yes, we do. A huge part of what's wrong with the media is too few people trying to fill too much time. It's nothing more pernicious than that. It's just that it's hard to make good television. It's hard. It requires labor. A lot of people, hard work, and doing live television 5 days a week is hard. And so, and the staffs in cable news are not huge. Rachel Maddow, who puts on, I think, the finest hour of television basically across all networks, five nights a week, I don't know, they have a staff of 18 people, maybe, something like that, 18 or 19. She works 14 hours a day. That whole staff works constant, nonstop. And it's reflected in the quality of the show, but that's what it takes. So a lot of, and this is true on the internet as well. I mean, a lot of the stuff that's terrible on the internet, whether it's Politico or HuffPo or BuzzFeed or whatever, and those are all sites I read and often write things I really like and enjoy and pass along, is just feeding the beast. Too few people, too much content. I had a mentor once when I first started writing who I went to with a piece and said, it's not working. And he said, cut it by a third. That usually fixes it. No one ever says that in the media environment we're in right now. You never have that luxury to cut things.
You've cited President Obama as an example of a success story in the American meritocracy. What's your view of his performance as president? Are you disillusioned?
I don't think I'm disillusioned because I don't think I had a ton of illusions to begin with. I'm deeply frustrated about certain things. I'm grudgingly admiring of certain things. I'm furious about certain things. And I'm genuinely in awe on certain things. It's a very complicated record. And I feel a whole set of complicated feelings depending on what the issue is and the topic is and things that I think, things that he's doing that I take huge issue with and I think should be the subject of way more criticism. The fact that American drone killed a 16-year-old kid who is Anwar al-Awlaki's son, who's a kid who grew up in Denver, who is an American citizen at a restaurant in Yemen while he was going to look for his father. Our dollars, our weapons. You can go look at the kid's Facebook page. That's a kid that we killed, us, the United States of America. No allegation, implication at all that he had anything to do with anything having to do with terrorism. The best explanation we have is that he was having lunch at a restaurant with someone who was implicated and was targeted for the strike. But there has been no explanation. There has been no explanation. This is an American citizen killed by American weapons. It does not seem to me too much to ask that the government account for what it did in taking this boy's life. On the other hand, there's going to be 30 million people in this country who don't have access to health insurance who are going to get it. And that is a remarkable thing. That is a tremendous improvement in the net amount of human happiness in the country. It is a vast reduction of misery and psychological burden and human burden, human toll. And those are part of the same record. And I feel really different about different parts of them.
High levels of taxation distort the behavior of individuals in the economy, causing them to take actions to avoid taxation that are inefficient, shrinking GDP, and affecting people of all income levels. Does the social goal that you propose merit lowering the standards of living of all Americans, not just the elites?
I just don't think that's the trade-off at issue right now, and I think that you should ask people who have lost their job in the Great Recession whether their standard of living has gone up or down. Financial crises lower standards of living. There's a lot of people with low standards of living. We have higher amounts of poverty than we've had in years. We have 45 million Americans on food stamps right now. Median wages in this country declined by 7% in real terms in the last decade. Net zero job creation under George W. Bush, the time of the lowest marginal rates in memory, net zero job creation was zero. Net job creation. So if what we were looking at was an actual trade-off between standards of living for everyone and this, you know, punitive tax on the rich, to sort of channel the sentiment there, I think I probably wouldn't take the trade because I want people to be better. I'm not really motivated here by some punitive desire or envy or whatever, class warfare, etc. I think it's actually a destructive system. I think it's unstable. I think it's going to produce more crisis. That's going to be bad for everyone. Eventually, of course, everyone. Like the whole ship goes down. We came really close to that. I mean, that's to get back to the president's record. I mean, don't discount how close we came. We really did come close to something like a total meltdown, like 30% unemployment. And that's terrifying. We're still, you know, the effects on standard of living have been devastating from just what we have had. The news that's coming out of England right now in terms of the growing scandal there around LIBOR, which again happened during the bubble years and then again in 2008, but it just makes you wonder how much things are on the level now.
Question from an audience member about the cynicism in this society. How do we get Americans to start saying yes on issues that are important for all, especially their elected leaders, with so many people voting no and things are so polarized in their political philosophies? How do we get a more upbeat assessment to take on some of these things that you're talking about?
I definitely don't have the antidote for cynicism. I mean, President Barack Obama's 2008 campaign was largely predicated on being successfully waging that battle quite successfully, explicitly. I mean, he would say, I am trying to combat cynicism. The polarization issue is one that I've started to think about and obsess over a lot because I think I used to think it was a fake issue that was basically pushed by fuddy-duddy members of the Washington establishment who didn't like to have their, who pined for their old parties, basically. And there is part of that. That is part of what drives this constant bemoaning partisanship. But increasingly, the data that we have shows that partisanship is quite real, and polarization along partisan lines and along ideological lines is quite real. And the process of sorting different personality types into conservative and liberal parties is getting more efficient. And people are actually living in more polarized geographical areas. Like, I have never lived anywhere that ever had a chance of electing a Republican. Well, I don't know if that's something to applaud. I mean, that's maybe that's the problem, right? I mean, and
they're,
there's a lot of people...
They're applauding in agreement.
Yeah. Right, that's right. Yeah, it's here in San Francisco. And and there's a lot of Republicans, many Republicans, who could say the same thing. They've never lived somewhere that had any chance of electing a Democrat. And there's this question, too, of the degree to which... So there's this polarization that's actually happening. It's happening both at the congressional level in terms of congressional votes. It's happening among people in terms of when you ask them to talk about, for instance, the difference in values answers. These are just these are questions of broad philosophy and values that Pew has been asking for since the early 1990s. The difference in the scores between liberals and conservatives keeps getting bigger and bigger. And largely it's been driven by the conservatives, who are moving further and further to the right. That's happening in Congress. It's happening in this Pew polling. So there's this asymmetric polarization that's happening, which has become, in one way, the defining feature of the American political landscape, and I think is kind of dangerous and terrifying. And I'm not sure what the way out of it is, but I have now come around to think it's a big problem.
To a certain degree, your book is aimed at an elite audience, I would say, overall, which goes to this question from an audience member. What can be done to make poor people feel like they can have a say in politics, if not to make things happen for them, at least to prevent things from happening to them?
That's a great question. I mean, I think what's happening right now, you know, the short answer to that is organizing, and that's always the answer. And I say this, that there's nothing in the world easier or cheaper than a writer suggests that other people organize. And I say that because my dad's an organizer and my brother's an organizer, and organizing is hard work. It's like when people talk about teaching, you know, it's like, oh, we need better teachers. It's like, yeah, go teach. Like, it's hard work. Organizing is hard work. It's the only way that power has ever been built, I think, for people. And, you know, what's going on with the Medicaid expansion is a perfect example. You guys are familiar with the one of the decisions in the Supreme Court that was actually joined by Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan, striking down the provision of the law that would require states to expand Medicaid up to 133% of the poverty line, or, if they didn't, see all of their Medicaid funding taken away. And the court said this was unconstitutional. This amounted to a gun to the head of the states. And said what you can do is threaten to take away the money. You know, if they don't go for the expansion, then they don't get the money for the expansion, but you can't take away their other Medicaid money. In the wake of that, we have seen, I think we're now up to 9 governors, but at least 7 governors, all Republican governors in Republican states, although Wisconsin also, Scott Walker, say that they're thinking of not going to expanding Medicaid. Now, under the provisions of the Affordable Care Act, keep in mind, of the 30 million uninsured who will get coverage, 17 million, the lion's share of that, comes from folks through the Medicaid expansion. It's the single biggest mechanism by which the law expands coverage for people. Okay? What these governors are saying is, just so everyone's clear about the funding structure here, for the first 3 years, the funding for the expansion is 100% paid for by the federal government, then goes to 95.5% and ends at 90.10. Gets phased into 90.10. Every dollar the state pays, the federal government comes up with $9. Now, this is to take people who are right now not in insurance markets and insure them, which all the hospitals want to see happen because they end up paying for people in the emergency room and people with chronic conditions that don't get cared for, et cetera. You have governors in 7 states saying, we don't want the money. We want these people to be uninsured. And they think they won't pay a political price for that. And it's scary to contemplate that they might not, because the folks that we're talking about, who are more or less the working poor, don't have a lot of political power. I mean, that is a stark example of the way these political calculations work. If they're going to take the Medicaid expansion, which eventually they will, it's going to be because the hospitals kick their butts. Because the hospitals want the Medicaid expansion, and the hospitals have political power. And every member of Congress and every state rep has a hospital in their district. They're like car dealerships. Those are the other, that's the other hidden power on Capitol Hill. Everyone's got a car dealership in their district. Everyone's got a hospital.
We have time for one more quick question or quick answer. Audience member obviously liked your book very much. Says, do you have a sequel in the works?
I'm toying with a few different ideas for the next book project. Possibly one on broadly about polarization, but more about persuasion and changes in public opinion and how and why people change their minds. And there's been a lot of research recently and a lot of popular books written about confirmation bias, about the fact that we tend to seek out like-minded opinions, and I'm, of course, guilty of this, and those of you nodding your heads in the audience are too. Case in point. But to me, the more interesting thing is why that doesn't always work, right? I mean, why do sometimes people change their minds or get persuaded? Because if it's impossible to do that, like, what the heck am I doing every week? Why are any of us doing this? So that topic interests me.
Great. Well, please join me in thanking Chris Hayes, editor-at-large of The Nation. Great reception. Host of NBC's Up with Chris Hayes and author of the new book, Twilight of the Elites, America After Meritocracy. We also want to thank our audiences here on the radio, on television, and on the Internet. Would also like to remind everyone here that copies of Mr. Hayes' new book are on sale in the lobby, and he will be pleased to sign them outside this room immediately following the program. I know a lot of you are going to want to talk to him, but we do appreciate allowing him to get to the book signing tables as quickly as possible. And now, I'm John Diaz. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.
That was great. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Great job.